Hello again, and welcome to another great show. What could be more futuristic than exoskeletons? The artist's impressions we've all seen of super strong construction workers and soldiers seem to point to a future in which Iron Man is real. External skeletons are a great way to increase the strength of individual humans, but we often forget that they are also an incredible means of returning movement and strength to disabled people, and even permitting paraplegics to attain something closer to a normal life. The way the exoskeletons are controlled, through computer-driven motors using conventional and AI programming, is every bit as important as the mechanics. But exoskeletons are here to stay, and Dr. Matthew Dickinson, a senior lecturer at the University of Central Lancashire, is our guest today to explain how they might help bring new life and opportunities to tens of thousands of people.
Thank you so much again for joining us, Matthew. So talking about exoskeletons then, we've all heard of science fiction like Iron Man and all of those different kinds of almost out of this world realms of exoskeletons. But just what really are they in real life modern situations?
To be honest, absolutely phenomenally good question to kick off with. The misconception at the moment from science fiction is that we're building these superhero type approaches that we can be super strong. But the bigger picture of this is think of it as we go shopping. And as we go shopping, we reach over and we grab our shopping bags. As we're holding the shopping bags, we're actually sustaining to the load. So we're holding it there. Now, don't get me wrong. The first few thousand times that you go shopping, holding that shopping bag, you'll probably be all right. You'll be able to recover. However, if you continue to do this right the way through to a good old age, what will actually start to happen is you'll start to get degradation around your joints, around the muscles. The idea of this is very sneaker. It is simply this. You're trying to redirect some of that loading and bypassing it, going through your joints and getting it to go through the skeleton itself. So if you think of this on a bigger scale, so let's say we are on a building site and we're holding a lot of weight, or let's say that I don't know how much experience you've had with this, but when you're actually holding your arm straight upwards to hold something up in space, so yeah. it could be a tool, to you're hammering in something into the ceiling, this strain at first is very uncomfortable. You and me both know that. But the more that we do this, it can have a lot of degradative effect. However, if we can offer a little bit of assistance, it will, again, redirect some of that force away from your muscles into the skeletal structure. And we normally anchor to a point. So let's play around with the idea of holding your arms up in the air. As your arms are up in the air, you're aiming to try and anchor down to your hips, because your hips are quite sophisticated development, let's say. And we can use that to redirect it. And what it'll allow us to do is to extend a better, longer, and healthier life. And that's the big implication of the skeleton.
Okay, so is that a sort of structure that goes around your limbs then?
Exactly. So the key theory of it is, think of it as a crutch. So when you have a crutch, you'll lean onto the floor and you'll bypass onto the floor. However, if you had a crutch piece that was attached to, say, your forearm, which was also attached to your bicep, and these were connected, this is where that skeletal structure starts to appear. And it is literally stolen from nature. So we are wearing the structure around the body, exactly like you said.
So this is what insects do, isn't it? They have an exoskeleton. And that exoskeleton, as you say, takes the strain and helps them to walk and move and all the rest of it.
It does. But what we're trying to do is steal some of that from nature and actually put it on to the top of ours. And that's where the real challenge comes, because an insect that has an exoskeleton will have key points around the outside joints that will allow their joints to move.
Yeah.
However, because we've got an internal skeleton and we're trying to get an external skeleton onto it, we've got to be careful about making sure we don't push a joint in the wrong place, or else we could promote injury.
Yeah. Right. So these sort of structures then, what sort of thing would they be made out of? Is it metal, plastics, or?
This is the next big thing within it. Now, this is such a, I'm trying my very best not to go crazy with this, but the materials themselves are vital. Now, since 1869, when Nicolaus Jargon formulated the very first form of what we'd ever thought to be an exoskeleton. Now, he was attempting to attach massive pneumatic rams to the back of his legs, and luckily he didn't achieve it. But you can see what he was trying to do. That's the important bit.
Was this a sort of leaping over tall buildings?
If you look at it, what he was actually doing, he was looking at grasshoppers. And if you look at the very, because he actually did some amazing drawings. But if you look, he was trying to do a bit of biomimicry where he was mimicking the design of the leg and trying to get humans to be able to do the same thing. If he'd have achieved it, sadly, probably wouldn't have been around to tell the tale. However, it's the thought that counts. So as this has developed and developed, what a lot of people have got to a point of is saying, If this is a hardened structure, depending on the application, we can make it from metal, or we can make it from composite. Now, your composite in this case will probably be carbon fiber. Or we could use a polymer, so we could make it plastic. Then, to make it even more complicated, some groups have come along and said, well, what if we actually generate this as a soft approach? Now, the soft approach is where we're trying to mimic muscular contraction. We're trying to mimic the way that our bodies will react in these key areas. Now, one in Bristol, what he nicknames the right trousers after the famous the famous Wallace and Gromit. He used a polymer-based graphene material. And what they were doing is they were heating up the graphene and it was causing temporary contraction. It behaved like a muscle. And you look at it and go, that is just beautifully genius. And obviously the point of relaxation of the material became a little bit hit and miss. However, the very first steps of this had a huge, huge ideas behind it. Now, Stanford have gone down a little bit different of an approach. They're using a combination of tiny pneumatics with some cable drives. Mm. Now, this type of approach is actually called exosuit. So you've now got two categories. You've got exoskeleton, which is your external structure, which is the hardened base, which goes around the body. And you have the exosuit, which mimics muscular contraction. And at the moment, they never tend to mix. However, until now, researchers are beginning to look at the idea of, what if we were to mimic the bone and the muscle? Would this be more efficient? And that is what we've been doing.
Okay. That's so crazy.
Right. Okay. Well, tell us about what you've been doing then. It sounds fascinating.
I will give you the quickest summary of where we'd started. Originally, my PhD is in tribology. I did a lot of work looking at material loss in pistons and looking at a lot of racing engines. And I finished my PhD and I've always been a firm believer in STEM. I've always been a firm believer in public engagement and encouraging those who don't believe in themselves to really open their eyes to say, I have that potential.
Yeah.
And this is just because my background, I am dyslexic. So what I tend to do is go out to schools and I try to promote it. Now, I've been involved over the few years. I was involved in a project called Primary Engineer. And it goes into schools, and they have a lot of engineers from places like Rolls-Royce, BAE Systems, who go into schools and say to kids, right, if you were an engineer, how would you solve a problem? Now, to give you an example, one of the things one year was a young boy who was getting told off by his mum daily for putting too much toothpaste on the toothbrush. So what he said is, why can I not have a toothbrush that when I press a button, toothpaste appears? And it turns out these things already exist. They're actually used to still offer independence for people with Alzheimer's. It's all such right. A great idea. But I thought it was ingenious and I loved it. And we built it. So we built him a little prototype, a working prototype. And phenomenal. One year, a young 15-year-old girl at the time, Christina Marshall, she put an entry in and it was something else. You know, when you read something and you go, this is changing even the way I'm thinking. Yeah. All she simply said is, my cousin has a disease called SMA. And why is there not a special shirt that she could wear to enable her to move? Now, personally, I'd never heard of SMA. And basically, it's a degenerative muscular disease that allows children, you kind of suffocate from the inside out. It's an awful thing. And, you know, when you read something, you think, this is bringing me to tears, because it was so specific. She'd really thought about it. And so I started looking. And I thought, I know what she's talking about. She's talking about an exoskeleton. I'm thinking, there must be billions of these out there. And there wasn't. In fact, to date, last year, there is now one that exists by a Spanish company. And I was like, no, this can't be right. So we ended up looking even more. And yeah, she'd hit a point of that no one's been looking at. So I reached out, because in my role, I often find just asking for permission to ask a question doesn't get a question answered. So no. I often just reach out and say, look, why is this not happening? So I reached out to some, I'll call them popular companies, and said, what is the reason for this? And they'd said, children grow. So when we develop exoskeletons, they can be into hundreds of thousands of pounds. Mm. When they grow, they outgrow them. And yeah, you just sink a little bit, but you understand from both sides why this doesn't exist. So we started looking. We produced the very first prototype. Originally, we were going to produce a skeletal structure, which basically we call it the continuum method. It has, it replicates a similar sort of design as a human skeleton. So we have a skeletal structure that goes up the back of the child. And we thought at first, just for this prototype, just to get the first one running, why don't we just CNC cut it? Just get some small billet pieces and get it cut. And then when we actually looked at the price to actually make the skeletal structure, it came back at 65,000. So we realized that wasn't going to be an option. And I got back to the office, did a little bit of sulking, and then realized, what if I printed it? And it was literally me sitting right here. And I just thought, if I printed it, surely that could offer some type of insight. So we started testing on the material. Now, just to give an insight for the base core, what we're looking at, it was a PLA, so it was polylactic acid. And it's a very off-the-shelf thing. What we'd always wanted in our approach towards these developments is we wanted this to be accessible, because I'm a child of tomorrow's world. Every time Tuesday night, I was always waiting for the new great thing to appear.
Me too.
So I'm still waiting for my flying car, which doesn't exist.
I know. Yeah. I put my indent in a few years ago, but that mine hasn't arrived either.
I know. And so we always wanted this to be cheap, wanted it to be affordable. We designed it a particular way so that as a child grows, you could add segments to the spinal column itself.
Yeah.
So we found a way that we believe to make the structure, rather than it being hundreds of thousands, a low-income family or the NHS could have access to be able to support any child for a shocking £1,000. That's including control system.
Oh, wow.
And it was just accident. And we sat there and thought, it can't be right. Now, don't get me wrong. First iteration of this, yeah, we realized quickly that the design had problems. Yeah. And we went back to the drawing board an awful lot. This is when I'd wander through my kitchen and say to my wife, what do you think of this? She'd just kind of sit there and go, yeah, that's very nice. Go away. But what we quickly realized is, one, typical exoskeleton design focuses their design on actuation of joints. Now, we always knew we could not be an exosuit because it's too expensive. But we knew if we were going to do an exoskeleton design, we were going to try and have a skeleton and the suit element. Mm. So what we were actually going to try and do is actuate muscular groups. Now, we call it the actuation of muscular contraction, which sounds really sophisticated, but basically we're trying to mimic the point of where the muscle contracts. And we're doing this by, they call it the Bowden approach. I don't know if you've heard of this. Basically, think of this as a brake cable on your bike. When you pull the cable pulls back and this levers the two brakes to get on the V brakes. I don't mean like your sophisticated ones. And using this method, because we can lower the coefficient of friction, using Bowden's methodology and actually using a custom-designed planetary gearbox, what we've come up with, we can mimic muscular contraction. And then what we have is we have a lower suit, which someone wears in, best way to see this will be like a skiing, you know, like your thermals underlayers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have thermal underlayers that sits underneath, which encourages muscles to move in the right way.
Yeah.
And then we have a skeletal structure, which goes over the top, which acts as that passive side. So in other words, we can mimic the key points of both elements. So we've combined both. And that's where there's been holes and there's still things that we're looking at to this point. And if we step back just slightly, the biggest issue that we'd hit was polylactic acid is a glucose-based material. Right. One thing that we started to realize is if you wear this against the skin, as human sweat hits this. Now, we want to make sure it's clean because if we've got somebody who's ill, we don't want to make them iller. So what we started to look at is if this is worn against the skin and the sweat combines with that PLA because it's glucose-based, we can now prove that the human sweat actually starts to devour some of the surface of that material.
No.
Then what happens is the sweat begins to sink into the substructure. And in essence, we can't clean it. So I've then gone back to the drawing board. I've been in touch with some incredible material scientists. And we're now with a new... This sample here is using a nanocomposite material, which has 5% copper particles in it. Now, I know copper's a big discussion at the moment as to how efficient it is to actually stop growth, but we're now running quite a few PhDs now looking at the cleaning procedure. And with the support that I got from ASTM, have been able to get me the company impact and company approach towards cleaning. And yeah, this... what I genuinely thought would be a project that would last for 2 months has actually turned out to be the rest of my life.
Are any children using this in a prototype form at all?
So at the moment, until we get to a comfortable state, I've just realized I'd not even told you a big finding for us is that when we tested the material, we realized it wouldn't just look after children. We realized that you could be an adult. And we realized that this would support an awful lot more than what we'd originally intended it to.
Oh.
We'd realized that, don't get me wrong, there is, like anything, we can get to a certain, let's say, mass size, to be respectful. you can get to a certain mass size and this will breach the material. However, the average male to female ratio of the UK, it will support. And right. we can now prove this.
That's incredible.
Over July, under obviously COVID restrictions, I got to say that, I was here at the university, and me and a fellow who's been working on this, we tested our first exoskeleton live on ourselves in the biomechanics laboratory. And you know when you've run simulations, you run these tests and you think, it'll be fine, it'll all work. But even when it's on a human body and all you're thinking is, please don't break. And yeah, when it came back, we noticed some really exciting results. We noticed a 5% decrease in ankle bracing, a 5% loading around the joints. And yeah, it's one of those moments where you think, this is working. So yes, it extremely exciting. And from here now, there's now an outreach project that we've put together to take this out to schools, to inform kids about what exoskeletons are.
Yeah.
Because the second most people hear about an exoskeleton, they think Iron Man.
Yeah. Of course.
And we have a running joke at ASTM. If anybody says Iron Man and exoskeleton in the same sentence, you have to buy a round.
Well, I'm so sorry about that.
Yeah. They're going to kill me. What was important to me is that any demonstration pieces that we do with schools, it informs not just children, I'd always say adults as well, that what this type of stuff does. So I designed from support from the Royal Academy of Engineering, I designed an arm exoskeleton, which we've now produced. So far today, we've produced 25 sets, which are going to go out to every school in the north. Originally, I'd asked we should just do this for 10 schools because I've only got two hands.
Yeah.
And we've ended up with schools right from northeast to northwest who are engaging with this. ASTM have come to us as well, and they're now going to be running this in America as well. And basically, I've set up five episodes, and each episode is about different elements of exoskeletons. Different places, and some of the leading experts have agreed to be interviewed. So people from Boeing, from NASA, and it's been a hell of a journey for me in many ways. So yeah, it's extremely exciting what we've been doing so far.
And so where do you see that going then? What kind of uses for these exoskeletons? Because I know you said it started with that unfortunate disease, but are there any other
applications for it? This goes on. Last year I got involved with, because you guys will know about the UK Space Agency.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got the different hubs. Mm-hmm. One of the hubs is a health hub. Now, a friend of mine, well, he wasn't a friend at the time. I did a presentation for the UK Space Hub, and I said to them, when an astronaut is moving from Earth to Mars, there's a lot of things that's going on. And when we consider health, just health, one important element to minimize levels of atrophy traveling through the astronaut's body is about their exercise.
Yeah.
And I said to them, if we're mimicking the point of contraction by assisting that drive, what if we mimicked both sides? So we didn't assist, but we resist.
Yeah.
What if we're in a lower G area and we actually get the body to work? So in other words, the muscles.
To 1G. Yeah.
Exactly. So the muscles actually think we're here on Earth. And then what you're actually in a position of is where the astronaut stays healthy, and we don't need the, because they're like the fold away gyms on a lot of the
shuttle. Yeah.
And what I'm proposing is what if the astronaut had the suit on, and depending on where they were, Earth, in journey to Mars, for example, the suit itself could change its orientation to suit the gravities that you were presently in. And we did a white paper. We produced this, and that got some great responses with it. Some great responses.
So NASA are interested, are they?
I'd love to say that they were. But these are the types of discussions that I've been lucky enough to be actually involved in when I've been involved with the ASTM's work. Because obviously these are all the different companies coming together to discuss how we're going to safely execute this type of technology for the future.
Because just from a layperson's point of view, it sounds like an ideal thing, because they're going to be wearing suits anyway on Mars. And if the suits have got resistive exoskeletons within them, then there is no difference. It's just health giving.
It is. I mean, with any of these types of things emerge, the biggest concern is with maintenance.
Yeah.
If we can assume that the suit would never fail and everything will be fine, this will be fantastic. And what we've been trying to do in our system is minimize components, minimize the level of things that's needed. So I've always my grandfather always used to say that the best types of designs are the ones that have the lowest number of parts.
Yeah.
And they really are. They really are. The less millions of parts that you've got, the better. We're desperately trying to operate to that condition. For these types of things, so much potential. So much potential.
So go on.
Oh, yeah, sorry. can't stop. So this as a training method for astronauts, I got involved with, I had a long conversation with one of our professors here who's studying a lot of stroke rehabilitation. And what she was telling us is it can be hard for the nurse's perspective, because a lot of the time you've got to actuate the joints to try and help people recover from a stroke.
Yeah.
And one thing that we proposed is that if we were doing this to resist for astronauts, in the future, because obviously this is just throwing out where this could actually sit, we could propose a method or a training method for somebody who's in stroke rehabilitation. So if they're in the bed, they could wear the suit and under supervision, obviously, but it would then allow to be consistent in the training. And how well that would work, because it's not really my area, it'd be hard to tell. But that as a tool to help some of these amazing nurses, I think, would be another element of where we could go.
That is really, really fascinating. I was just thinking as well, like, could this ever potentially, in the far future, I imagine, extend to paraplegics in terms of helping them walk again?
That's another area, actually. So if you do get a chance, this is one of my favorite projects of all time. It's a project called the Walk Again Project.
Okay.
And this project has been running for, 10, 15 years now. And in the last World Cup in Brazil, if that's when the last World Cup was, the Walk Again Project demonstrate a young guy who broken his back. He was paraplegic from the waist down, and he walked on the football pitch and he kicked a ball. Now, the thing that still makes me sick to this day, UK never covered it. However, if you Google this, someone on YouTube recorded it over YouTube. It's not the best recording, but you do actually see this suit and you do see him kick the ball. And you know when you think, that is why we do it. That is exactly why we do it.
That is magic.
And it is. It's life-changing. And another one is the E-legs. Originally came out of Berkeley. And the E-legs was formulated under the idea of that it was going to be used. They used to nickname it the Hulk. Yeah. And it was targeted from, it was actually originally formulated by the idea from Lockheed Martin. And they were going to use it for soldiers to carry heavier weights.
Yeah.
Didn't work well. It didn't allow the soldiers to have mobility. However, transformed paraplegics' lives. And now this suits do allow them to mimic walking.
Yeah.
The Walk Again project uses EEG, so uses brain waves and tries to decipher the brain waves to actually give you some level of motion. But where we are at the moment is still very, very early days. A lot of the control systems that we use, it is still very, very primitive, if you will, in comparison to what the human body does, because we are very sophisticated.
Yeah, in many ways, the control systems are at the heart of this, aren't they? And do you... Presumably, some of them are AI driven.
Mm-hmm. So, we've been looking at different streams at the moment. Now, looking at something like drop foot, which is where the front tibial muscles become overextended, where you cannot raise your foot all the way.
Yeah.
A lot of patients, what they will do is as they walk, they almost flick their foot.
Yes.
Or they end up with what they call an AFO, an ankle foot orthotic, which is a rigid structure that sits at the back of the calf onto the foot to allow them to have some level of mobility.
Yeah.
We've been using what they call impedance control. So the idea of that your muscle will, your foot as it's raising, and what we're trying to do is as it raises, we're trying to tell the AI system a very easy early learning method of just, if the foot raises to this degree, try and get it to raise up to the rest of the way, which that for a simple motion is dead easy. However, if we start to look at something more sophisticated, like the core, like where your central core, being able to sit up, being able to have an oblique twist, anything like that. The trouble is we have so many different muscles firing, and trying to read the muscles as they're actually firing. The trouble is we use the muscles in other elements. So for example, if we sneeze, as we sneeze, we inhale, and what we do to try and keep our core steady is we'll tense the lower core. So we'll sneeze and we'll hold it. Now, if we don't use an AI system to try and decipher exactly what's going on, what happens is we sneeze and we do the world's most exaggerated sneeze because we'll, So what it then means is we need a way to use linear discriminant analysis, which it's funny. Linear discriminant analysis is how our credit rating is calculated, where we will categorize people.
Yeah.
And we'll say, yeah, you're in the upper band, you're in the lower band. Now, if you remove the term band and say, yeah, this is for sitting down muscle groups, this is for walking groups, this is for sneezing, and pardon my French, but this is for when you're on the loo, because these are all muscle groups that get used. What we do then with these categories is we pass these through to a neural network, which will, in essence, try and keep that that average down a bit. So we can kind of say, yes, that's what's happened. And that is really what we've been doing at the moment. We've been trying to use that to see if we can sharpen that as a delivery method.